I don't know. Hey, Mary Nolan.
Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Monday, February 6, 2012. The first bill we're going to deal with is House Bill 4023. There was not a sign-up sheet. We've had the discussion on the bill. However, I did want the Chief Justice to have an opportunity to talk a little bit about the bill. Would you come up, please?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul DeMunez. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. I appear here this morning, however, in my individual capacity as a member of the Marion County community. I have spent a good deal of time working with Catholic Community Services. With me is Jim Seymour, the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services here. We serve the Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. The bill, 4023, is just part of a broader initiative that we have had in this community for some time. I'm not sure all of you have heard of the initiative called Fostering Hope. It's been recognized nationally as one of the foremost programs in the country in eliminating the maltreatment of children and reducing the number of children that need to be in foster care. This is just one small part of that. I wanted to make sure I addressed any concerns that I had heard before, that people were concerned that somehow some fly-by-night agency or someone not qualified would end up as an advocate or a guardian. And of course, first of all, the bill provides that they would have to be certified by DHS, and second of all, they'd have to be approved by our juvenile judges in this state. And I'd also like to acknowledge that Judge Dan Waller, the presiding judge in Multnomah County, is here, one of the foremost experts on children's issues in this state. And I've worked with her on this bill, and she does also support this bill. So I wanted to make sure that that you knew that this fits into a much broader scheme. I signed an agreement with Governor Kulongowski a couple of years ago, committing both of our branches of government to the safe reduction of children in foster care, and this is just one small part of that. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Any members, any questions? Representative Cormier.
Thank you, Judge, for coming today and for bringing up this bill. Could you show us where in the bill itself there is that safeguard that we will not be fly-by-night?
You know where it is from the statutes? Yeah. Community guardian means a child-rearing agency licensed under ORS 418-205 to 418-310 that is petitioning for appointment as a guardian or ward under ORS 419B.365.
I can appreciate that. I guess, if I may, Chair, thank you. What in those two pieces of legislation that you're citing states that, I mean, I can appreciate, we're talking about Catholic Family Services, and I had children, actually foster right. children through Catholic Family Services. I'm very supportive of that. But I am concerned there aren't unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So I need some assurance.
Okay, I'll ask Jim. Can you answer that question?
The agencies licensed under this particular legislation as child care agencies are providing residential care and treatment for thousands of Oregon's children.
Can you see your name, please?
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services. This is the legislation that allows licensing of residential treatment and treatment foster care programs that thousands of Oregon children are in right now. The programs are reviewed and licensed. It's a very strict standard. In addition to for Catholic Community Services' sake, in addition to these standards, we are also nationally accredited by the Council on Accreditation of Children and Families Programs. And I can tell you just that these standards that we have to meet with the state licensing bring us very close to national accreditation. I personally don't see how a fly-by-night organization could meet the standards of licensing to be able to care for Oregon's most vulnerable children.
Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning and welcome. Thanks for being here. Your Honor, we spoke just a few minutes ago, and I wanted to clarify, since I haven't actually gotten a chance to give you this information since we spoke, I'd like to actually give the Chief Justice this language. It's language specifically assuring, it would be an amendment that would explicitly ensure in the bill that as the youth, the ward, approached his or her 18th birthday and therefore adulthood under state law, that there be one final review in which, through the courts, in which the youth and any advocates for that youth were given very clear information about the consequences of participating in this program mm-hmm. through the point of the 18th birthday. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but the hearing happened before we could have this conversation outside, so I'd like to give you the language, as I heard you say you were comfortable with the language.
I am. Yeah, I have no problem with that.
I might.
Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, do we have this amendment?
No.
Sorry. Okay. If we don't have Mr. Chair, it is language that we've submitted to Legislative Council, but in the crunch that they're under, we don't actually have that amendment drafted in LC form back to us.
Representative Nolan, when was it submitted to them?
Friday.
And we may expect it today or tomorrow?
We told them that the hearing was at 8 o'clock this morning. But
and also, we'd have to have a revenue impact or suspend the rules to move it without that if we get into a time crunch.
Mr. Chair, I would suspect that the revenue impact would be de minimis, but we would get that through LFO pretty quickly, too.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Regarding
the language that Representative Nolan has introduced here just now to the Chief, I don't want to create a conflict here, but I would be very interested in Judge Waller's opinion on this with her background and her, I mean, being on the ground level of dealing with this. If she could come up and kind of take a look at it really quick, and I would be curious her thoughts regarding that language.
Wonderful to have a lawyer like Judge Waller next to you.
Andy. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. I am aware of the language, and I think that there is a benefit to the court seeing a case prior to a young person turning 18 for one final hearing because of the potential consequences in terms of access to some financial resources after 18, and it assures that, in fact, there's full information for the youth. In terms of the question about what's the financial impact, my understanding is that Representative Nolan is correct, that it would be de minimis. In fact, by having the guardianship, there are fewer hearings that there would be if the youth had a plan of permanency of another planned permanency living arrangement, which requires regular hearings throughout the course of the youth's minority.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Committee members, anything further?
Judge Waller,
yes.
We've been for hours in rooms talking about dependency and how do we take care of children, how do we consider grandparents and all this. This type of legislation is a little different concept. Should we be fearful of new ideas and concepts, and if they're thought out, that would possibly help a certain segment of kids that might fall in there?
I know that Catholic community, and that's a good question, Representative Krieger, after all the hours that we've spent discussing permanency for children. Catholic Community Services is absolutely on board with the idea that we should always look to the highest level of permanency for every child, which means a family, return to parent, placement with relatives, placement with grandparents. Unfortunately, and I wish it were not so, sometimes for some children, despite extensive efforts and very diligent efforts on the part of the community, relatives, the courts, and DHS, we have not been able to find permanency. And there is nothing worse for a child who we have not found the permanency with a relative or with parents to go through foster home after foster home after foster home. That does damage. And this bill, by having a place-based permanency plan, provides for permanency for children who right now are not getting permanency. One of my last hearings of last week was a young man who we raised. He has had more than 30 placements. That is not okay. And so this allows for a very small defined, after extensive efforts have been made to find permanency with a relative, allows for this option.
Thank you very much. Anything further, committee?
Please.
Yeah, thank you all for your work. So 30 placements, can we get that number down so it just triggers so they go to a place where they can be more permanent?
We are working along with the Department of Human Services, the legislature, on really looking at how do we make sure that we have permanency at the earliest point possible for children. I believe that our efforts are that we have the right plans in place so that we don't have children who end up with 30 placements. In this case, unfortunately, the young man had had a failed adoptive placement that was fairly destructive for him, and it was difficult then to make an attachment to a family. So quite frankly, having something where he didn't have to step up to the plate and make that kind of attachment, but he had permanency, would have been of benefit to him.
Co-chairs, Representative Schauffler, there's a better answer than that. Fostering hope is a better answer for all of us than these children ending up in foster care. The Fostering Hope Initiative that we have here in Marion County, Yamhill County, and soon to be expanded into Polk County is one of the best programs in the country. It's a neighborhood-based program in which we're intervening in the lives of these children, strengthening their families and sustaining them, and reducing the number of children in need of foster care. And that's where we should be putting our efforts.
And I would agree with the chief that what we need is community stepping up and providing both for the families and the children who are within our neighborhoods.
Let me make one clarification. I didn't mean I had a better answer than that. I meant that as an abstract matter, there's a better answer for us. Obviously, you can tell how much she knows about this subject.
Committee.
Thank you for clearing that. I was sort of taken aback by that. Judge Waller, help me understand this boy who has been in, I assume it was a boy.
Yes, he was.
Placement. So this boy then is placed with Catholic Family Services or another agency who would provide guardianship for him. At 18, all he wants is to be out on his own. So what effect will that be on him if he goes into this maybe at 16 or 17? At 18, he says, I'm out of here. So my concern is he's lost any chance of extending his medical care and maybe other resources that he might have if he were still under DHS.
Representative Tomei, that's why I think that it's important to have this last safe kind of check in place of having the one more hearing before a youth turns 18. Now, Catholic Community Services has made a commitment beyond age 18, and I anticipate that for most youth, they will realize upon turning 18 that really leaving a home with somebody to provide food and education and guidance will not be a good thing. But if they are thinking, gosh, I want to leave Catholic Community Services, having a court hearing so there's an explanation of what is likely to happen, what they're going to lose, whether they leave Catholic Community Services or choose not to come back into DHS, I think is very important, because oftentimes you are right. At age 18, kids are saying, I'm an adult now and I want to go. I will say that what we found is that as kids turn age 18, in fact, although it's somewhat counterintuitive, they change their tune. They begin to realize what being on their own means. And many of them right now, because they think that age 18 will mean that they are out, they begin to undermine their own progress, which of course we want to avoid. So having them know that they are with Catholic Community Services, that there will still be caring adults who will be right beside them and provide for them beyond age 18. And for those who we have a hearing and they choose to come back into foster care, that again will continue the support that they have right now. So I would agree with you. I see this as important, but I know that Catholic Community Services is committed beyond age 18, and I think that the youth in getting the support that will reduce that leap into independence that many times we know most children with their parents aren't truly independent until about age 24.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One quick follow-up, just so that I understand it, and either Judge Waller or Mr. Seymour, you referenced Catholic Community Services' commitment beyond age 18. Is that a legally binding or enforceable commitment?
Jim, I'll let you
say your name.
For the record, my name is Jim Seymour. Co-Chairs, Representative Nolan, I don't believe so. When the youth emancipate, they become their own guardians. But it is a morally binding commitment, and our purpose here is to, if you have the community step up, there will be an individual who will be the advocate for this youth alongside of Catholic Community Services. And our commitment to them is that they would get the same kind of support that you or I would give our children as they try to go off to college or trade school or an apprenticeship program until they are able to financially support themselves. What we see happen over and over again, the kids go out and they fall on their face and they're homeless. And then they have a choice to call back the very people that we've been trying to keep them away from for years because the family isn't fit to care for them. They can call them and they say, sure, come back here. You can help us deal drugs, or if you're a young woman, you can come back here and put up with the incest. And they don't have anybody else to call right now. What they will have if this bill passes, they have a choice. They can call us, and we will provide a safe, stable, nurturing home for them. We'll hold them accountable for whatever it was that had them be out on their own. But we will be there for them. They have a place to come back to and what Juan said the other day when he was here. You know, you fall down five times, you get up six times. These kids have to have that kind of a place to come back to, just like you would do for your daughter or I would do for my grandkids.
And I want to also just echo the sentiment of gratitude for the availability of this program. I'm just interested in making sure that the interests and rights of every youth who chooses to participate or doesn't choose to participate are also protected on their own behalf. And thanks for your work.
Just a comment, maybe. I can't recall a percentage figure, but 70% hits my mind of foster kids that end up in the correctional system at some point in their life.
Yeah.
I would suspect if you have young men and women in a setting like this at the end, you know, before they become an adult, the type of guidance that they're going to get probably would help reduce that number, especially out of that particular group.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'll give you a little different statistic that I think makes your point. Last year, 13,000 children in Oregon spent at least one day in foster care. There are currently incarcerated in this state 14,000 prisoners.
Okay, thank you very much.
I wanted, in answer to Representative Nolan's question, this is Judge Waller. As you probably know, juvenile court wardship and guardianship can continue until after age 18 until age 21, but if wardship terminates prior at age 18, they can't come back into care, or if they leave care after age 18, they can't come back. So that the amendment provides that last check before they're 18, and even if they're in Catholic Community Services, guardianship can continue past age 18. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Co-Chair Krieger, I want to thank you for asking Judge Waller to come up, because you can see how helpful that was.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're not going to go into work session. We haven't done that. We have the amendment, would appear, that Representative Nolan's been working with the Chief Justice. And Chief Justice, would you make sure you make a contact with Bill Taylor on the amendments? Okay, thank you. We're also not going to go out of order right now to accommodate legislators, because if we start doing that, the testimony is going to cause some bills never to ever get through the process during this short time. We're going to go to House Bill, open a work session on House.
You need to say carry that over.
Yeah, we're going to carry it over until the Wednesday on 4023. On House Bill 4025, we'll open a work session. Mr. Taylor's not here. I'm going to stand by for Mr. Taylor here in a minute. Amendment.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council. I believe you have two sets of amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct. Dash one, dash two.
Dash one, and you should have a dash three, I believe. Bill, I think, had prepared them this morning. The dash three replaces the dash two.
I don't have the dash threes.
4025.
The dash twos.
I actually brought copies if if you'd like to have those.
Dash one and two amendments.
The dash one amendments are actually technical amendments that I had recommended that bill bring to the committee for consideration. The first one is in line 17 of the bill, which is the list of the small fine provisions that the bill exempts from the $60 payment that we talked about last week. And the problem was is that the final statute in that list, 83990, was intended to be just the invasive species license that you need now for your canoe or your kayak. And instead, that's several other marine violations in addition that we didn't want to cover, so it simply narrows it down to the one we were aiming at. The other thing the Dash 1 amendments does is to make it very, very clear that the unitary assessment and the county assessment that went away with 2712 on January 1st will still be collected on citations that were issued before January 1st. We want to make it clear that the same pattern for the unitary assessment, et cetera, carries on, and that the new $60 charge only applies to offenses that occur on or after January 1st. So it's a clarification to make it very, very sure, basically saying that was the intent and that's what we want to do. So the dash one really is a technical amendment. The dash three amendments are not technical. As you know, as I indicated last week, the bill made many, many changes to provisions of the law that provided for distribution of fines to specific entities, adding a lot of complexity and often for offenses that didn't get charged very often. And one of those that we changed related to special districts, which said that basically if a special district had a ordinance that provided for a fine, that after the court had collected the amounts and taken out their costs, that they would pay the full amount over to the district. Most of the districts that this was referring to probably either had no such ordinances, or if they did, the court's probably not doing that. I mean, the districts that were covered by this law included things like weather modification districts and library districts and things like that, and it was highly unlikely that these were of much significance. However, there was one that did have significance, and that one of the districts that was covered was TriMet, Mass Transit District. And as you may have seen in the Oregonian on Saturday, one of the consequences of the change was is that even at the time this was adopted, they were not issuing that many citations, but they have ramped up their collection efforts in December to where they, I understand, according to the Oregonian, I think they said they were issuing 10 times as they used to, 10 times the number, and they had hired several people to issue these citations for fare violations on TriMet operated buses and MAX. So the issue suddenly was that they were counting on the revenue. They were one of the districts that had established a relationship with Multnomah County and the circuit courts in Clackamas and Washington County where they operate, to where they were receiving monies back and were anticipating receiving that, and our 2712 had eliminated that payback to them from the courts on the citations being issued. They are also somewhat unique of these different districts in that they have a statute that says that they can have a police force that can issue citations. You know, not any public body can go out and start issuing citations. You need to have authority, and they were one of them that had that. The other one is Port of Portland. I have not heard, you know, from what I have heard, they're not concerned with this change, but they also have airport police and other folks with Port of Portland. I don't think any of the other districts that were covered had that type of provision. So what the Dash 3 amendments will do is basically put them, the district or the TriMet, back to where they were at before. We tried to arrive at some numbers that would get them to where they were at before 2712 went into effect. You know, hopefully with these numbers, they should get you there, and they should be receiving. They were only receiving, on average, according to the paper, about $20, and part of it was a collection issue. As you might expect, a lot of the citations issued for not having fares went to people who were not going to have $170 to pay the ticket, and so there was probably a high non-payment on these, but that's not taken into account here. This just gets them back to where the raw numbers were approximately, where they'll be getting about $65 or something out of the 170 if they collect the 170. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on page 2, on line 1, there's no amount of money. So how do we deal with that?
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Representative Tomei. The purpose of subsection 2 is actually to a retroactive payment to cover the citations that have been, the offenses that have occurred since January 1st. We didn't have a number to try to get even an estimate of what that would be through the effective date of this act. TriMet was working on that, but because of the time frame, it was necessary. My understanding, the bill is going to Ways and Means, and by the time we get there, we should have a number to insert.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. These funds, when they get to TriMet, do they go into the general fund, or are they restricted funds in some way?
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, Representative Wan. I don't know the answer to that. I assume it goes into their general, to their general fund.
I'm getting a nod yes from the TriMet representative. I don't know if I have the power to call you up, though. Thank you, Co-Chair Barker.
Aaron Dees with TriMet, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger. Yes, general fund.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones into House Bill 4025.
Representative Barker has moved the dash one amendments into House Bill 4025. Is there any objections? Any discussion? Amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments into 4025.
Representative Barker has moved the dash three amendments into House Bill 4025. Any discussion? Objections? The amendments are in. We are going to carry the bill forward till we get the revenue impact plan on probably moving it Wednesday. If we can have it by that time, we should have it by that time.
Chairman, members of the committee, I hope so.
Okay. Then I'll close the work session on House Bill 4025. Carry it over, like I said, till Wednesday. Work session on House Bill 4163. Mr. Taylor, where
Mr. Chair,
are we
members
on this?
Of committee, House Bill 4163 comes to you from the Court Administrator's Office, and this is a bill that changes Court Security Officer to Judicial Security Marshal and Court Security Personnel to Judicial Security Personnel. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee, Mr. Chair, members of committee. We have the paperwork.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Bill 4163 to Ways and Means.
Mr. Barker has moved that House Bill 4163 be passed and moved to Ways and Means. Any Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that we have a statement that has a minimal impact, expenditure impact, so why are we sending it to Ways and Means?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, because the leadership office has put a prior referral to Ways and Means.
Got it.
Prior
okay.
referral on it.
All right, thank you.
You can take care of it down there, ma'am.
We'll take care of it, but I'm with Representative Tomei. I don't know that we need to, but.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Okay, fine.
Okay, Representative Barker has made the motion to send House Bill 4163. Any other discussion? Call the roll.
Representative
Dolan?
Yes.
Representative
Olson? Excused.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative
Wand? Excused.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
House Bill 4163 will move down to Ways and Means. Passes of that.
That's untrue.
We will not need a carrier down there. Where did my list go?
I'll get it to him.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4095. Greg Zillard here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am State Rep. Bill Girard, District 56, Southern Klamath County. Members of the committee, you've seen this bill before. You passed this bill before when it was House Bill 3615 in the last session. Now it's House Bill 4095. Basically, it creates three pilot counties with an intergovernmental agreement to study ag and forest land use designations within their respective counties. We are working with Richard Whitman, the governor's natural resources advisor, who sent us this email over the weekend that I'd like to read to you. Here is a markup of the House Bill 4095 amendments that I was provided with last week. The changes are largely non-substantive and generally conform the bill to the language that was agreed upon toward the end of the 2011 session and clean up some ambiguities in the LC draft. Substantively, I will recommend that the governor sign the bill in this form, leaving aside for the moment the 2012 appropriations issue. In essence, we're going to have to come back to you with an amendment to concur with Mr. Rittman's request. We'll have that amendment to you in a matter of days. I have a letter from a constituent that pretty well sums up the importance of this bill. It says, "Dear Representative Girard, to strengthen Oregon's real estate market, economy, and quality of life, it is essential that communities have the flexibility they need to develop and eliminate barriers to housing affordability and economic success. The fundamentals of the bill are the result of the Big Look Task Force, which spent years examining Oregon's top-down land use system. One of their primary findings was that our land use system needed to be more accurately reflect the tremendous diversity in our state. House Bill 4095 authorizes a pilot project in Southern Oregon that will allow local counties to petition the state for definitions of farm and forest lands that take into account regional differences in farm and forest practices in order to more accurately identify suitable land for housing, preservation, and all economic industries. The benefits will include strengthening local job creation and employment opportunities, decreased conflict with urban and rural needs, as true farm and forest lands will be more accurately identified. The ability of a local elected official to better determine the quality of life for their communities. As Oregon's rural counties struggle to remain financially viable, House Bill 4095 will provide a critical tool for local leaders to address their local economy, housing affordability, and quality of life for their residents. I ask that you support House Bill 4095 and help communities determine their quality of life and strengthen their housing affordability and economic opportunities." That letter came from a Mrs. Linda Calouse, 403 Main Street in Klamath Falls. Committee, that's basically my testimony. We will be back with the amendment as requested by Mr. Whitman that will conform with both his and the governor's request. I ask that when we return with those amendments that you'll move this bill on to Ways and Means.
Committee, do you have any questions of Representative Girard? He may need to get on to another committee before we get to Representative Esquivel.
It's not a question, Mr. Chair, and you can predict what I'm going to say. It is just wrong that the people that live in the valley here in urban areas are dictating to you all what you're doing in your community. You know how to take care of your soil, your water, your timberlands better than the people that live up by where I live. Period. It's so wrong, and it would be equally wrong if you and your community were dictating to us up where I live how to maintain and take care of our community. There's only one thing wrong with this bill, and it's tearing my heart out because I'm hurt by it. It's because my name isn't on it. Where were you guys? Should have come around and asked me to be on it. This is a great bill, Mr. Chair. We need to allow the people that live around this state to be able to control their own future instead of tying their hands when the unemployment rate in some of these counties is just unacceptable. And it would be insensitive not to pass this bill, in my humble opinion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wiesner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing this forth again. For the record, Central Oregon has higher unemployment than the three counties here. We wish you luck. For the record, we are going to consider Central Oregon, I think, is the second part of this pilot program.
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Wisnet, yes, it is. If this project is a success and the legislature sees fit, we will designate another three counties, these up toward obviously your district, for the next round, so to speak.
Representative Schaffer's point, I was looking at the sign-up sheet where it says, do you live 100 miles from the meeting location? 13 people, not one of them, is from what I call way out in rural Oregon. Your country, my country, Ontario, people that have been affected by our land use bill. So I'm looking forward to the discussion. And if you need to go, you can. If you want to stay, you can do that. Representative Esquivel, do you want to make a few comments?
Thank you. For the record, Representative Sal Esquivel, District 6, Medford, Oregon, which is, of course, getting out in rural Oregon. I've come to a conclusion, being in this building as long as I have, that we have two Oregons. We have the Willamette Valley, and then we have the rest of Oregon, especially when it comes to land use. What's good for Lakeview is not necessarily good for Portland, and what's good for Portland isn't good for Ontario. This gives an opportunity for us to go back and take care of some of the damage that was done in the 70s when Senate Bill 100 came about. And it wasn't due to Senate Bill 100. It was a good bill. But what happened is my county jumped in and inadvertently overlaid zoning on properties without knowing what the properties were, with the intent to go back in the future to correct that.
The future has been 40 years in the past.
We've still not addressed this problem. And it's become so expensive for an individual to change the wrong and make it right that it's up to us now to make it right. This is a first step for us to redefine some of these timberlands and some of these agricultural lands that were miszoned in the first place. And I ask for your indulgence and I ask for your support that we proceed on this and allow people in local areas to make their own destiny because they know what's best for their own country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming that the amendment that's on our bill summary, this is the amendment that Representative Garrard was talking about. Is that correct?
Is it, Bill?
No, this amendment that Mr. Whitman requested just came up over this weekend. So we'll be back with that amendment for the committee, and then with that amendment, the bill would need to be referred to Ways and Means.
So, May, which amendment do you have?
He's talking about staff summary sheets.
Yeah. I don't have an amendment in the bill. That's why I'm asking, because it refers to an amendment, the effective committee amendment. But I have no copy of an amendment.
And that's on 4095.
Yes, sir.
We had Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Tomei. We did have some amendments that we put into the bill that were minor word changes that were suggested by legal counsel. And those changes are what Mr. Whitman is objecting to, so we're putting the bill back the way it was.
I understood there was an amendment coming. I don't have a copy of either. Some of us do, some of us don't. Vice Chair May, are you okay with understanding which amendment he's referring to then?
Well, I wish that we did have the amendment that is referred to in the staff measure summary.
And we're not going to move the bill today.
That's fine.
So we'll make sure you have it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just very quickly, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So how many, Representative Girard and Escobar, how many times and for how many years have you tried to get this bill or a similar bill passed here in Salem?
This would, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Wand, this is my third attempt.
Third session.
The third session. Prior to that, I was chair of the Land Use and Environmental Committee. Things were a little easier then.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Okay, we're going to start off the sign-up sheet. Well, as I said, there's 13 people here. And there's no way you can talk for 20 minutes apiece, or we'll not even get this bill, the hearing done on it. And if we don't, every other bill in judiciary could be in jeopardy. I'm going to give you 3 minutes. Say what you've got to say, oppose the bill, make a couple points, and then allow us to get on with the next people. I'm going to call up... And we do have, like you say, one more bill, 13. Just look at the time frame here. Yeah, two to three minutes, and I'm going to call you and go to the next person sitting there. Have Roger, it's K-A-Y-E-K, yes. Richard Hersey, and Paulette Alexander, please.
Good morning, co-chairs. My name is Roger Kay. I'm passing out the testimony this morning to you all. Friends of Marion County, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, opposes HB 4095 and requests that this bill not be passed out of committee. We oppose the measure because it has a substantial fiscal impact of $600,000. In these times of tight budgetary restraints, these funds could have a greater impact in serving the people of Oregon. We oppose the measure considering the former history of Measure 3749. Over 60% of voters of Measure 49 agreed that farm and forest protections are necessary to the health and welfare of Oregonians. HB 4095 negates that vote by providing exceptions from our statewide land use laws to three counties and opens the door to future exceptions invoked by both the courts and legislative action. We oppose the measure because groundwater availability may be affected that serves farmers and other users. We oppose the measure because farms and forests adjacent to cities will be threatened by sprawling subdivisions and other developments which threaten our transportation systems. We oppose the measure because UGBs will be compromised. Subdivision, commercial, and industrial development outside of cities will become a threat to the availability of services to the current city residents. These are but a few of the reasons this measure should not be passed out of your committee. Please vote no, and thanks for listening.
If ever one of you wants to be next.
I'm Richard Harrisay, co-chairs and chair. I am here to represent Occupy Oregon, Occupy Salem, Oregon. And the statement that I need to make here is that we agree with everything that 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Marion County, Friends of Marion County, have proposed here as in opposition to this bill. In addition, it must be brought to your attention that there is heavy influence on this legislation by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, an organization which we consider immoral at the very least and probably illegal. That's in the courts now. In fact, over one half of the sponsors of this bill are ALEC members, and quite coincidentally, they're all Republicans.
ALEC is an organization that seeks to subvert the sovereignty of the people by using a state-by-state approach. They bring together corporate lobbyists, which include the Koch brothers, ExxonMobil, and Walmart, and many other corporations, who pay to be members and then invite legislators paying their expenses in the form of scholarships to instruct them on how to move the ALEC model legislation through their state. Such legislation rarely, if ever, represents the will of their constituents. This is thinly veiled bribery. It is unconscionable that Oregonians should be subject to the surreptitious influence of out-of-state interests.
Hello, good morning. My name is Paulette Alexandria. I have a small farm in North Marion County. I'm also a member of the Marion County Planning Commission and a registered Republican. And I'm just representing myself, and I wanted to give testimony on this bill. We live in a very diverse state. We have very strong land use laws at this time, but they're transparent and amendable. I don't believe we need to change our current land use laws. I believe that the problem in these counties is a lack of economic diversity and not that they don't have local control. And I lived in Jackson Josephine County for 20 years before moving to this area. And during those years, I was a realtor. My family were realtors. I actually was acquainted with some of the people in this room who are realtors and now state representatives. Because there is no economic development or very low amount of jobs in those areas, people go into real estate and housing development and land development as a way of life. And this has been growing since the 60s. People have been turning away from farming. So the people are dependent on selling off real estate to make a living. You can see the outcome of this in our boom and bust economy that is very, very serious in these counties. They simply have no economy, so they're dependent on selling off real estate. I have put in my testimony Fannie Mae foreclosure site you can go to see the disproportionate amount of foreclosures in Jackson County, only second to Deschutes County, that this type of development mentality and economy creates. It is not an economy that's sustainable and puts more development pressure on our forest and timberlands. And there's no end to the development that is gained by allowing counties to circumvent our existing land use planning laws. What these counties need is more diversified economy and employment base, so there's less pressure to sell off their natural resources. Another approach would be for us to put bills in place to help them learn to farm. People that have farmland learn to farm instead of having to sell it off for subdivisions. That would be a wonderful thing for us to do at the state level, instead of thinking of ways to help people do more development and sustain that housing market, instead of giving them a real diversified economy down there. My own brother and sister-in-law were involved in this housing bubble. They lost 10 properties and became divorced as a result of that housing market in Jackson Josephine County. This is not a sustainable economic model.
Well, you got about 15 seconds.
Okay. The real estate and housing market dependent economy is just a way of life driven by desperation. It is a boom and bust economy, a live or die economy. Just as poachers in Africa kill the elephants and rhinos for their tusks, the real estate developers are killing off our forest and farmlands to make a short-term living. It is one way to survive economically in these counties,
Thank
but
you.
It's not the best way for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Call up another panel now. Eileen Kay. There's a Brian. I can't read your last name. Starts with an H.
Heinz.
Bad writing. And Sarah Grumling. Please state your names and then in any order you want, please.
Aileen Kay. I live in Turner, Oregon, which is southern Marion County. Chair Barker and Chair Krieger and members of the committee, I am testifying against this bill. I also have submitted testimony from somebody who could not be here today, Richard Reed, Chair of Salem City Watch. I do live in a rural area. I have three horses. I am very concerned about the loss of farmland for the horse industry. We need places to house our horses, to ride our horses. We need farmland to grow hay for our horses. The horse industry has saved many youths from doing bad things when they have too much free time. So what I am concerned about is that if you let three counties do this, it sounds, these three in particular, it sounds like they want housing developments and that the farmland will be gone. So I am just totally against this. Also, if you let, I consider this a gateway, like a gateway drug to the end of our land use system. If you let one county do this, I don't see legally how you can stop every county from doing it. I think it's a very dangerous idea. Also, somebody mentioned the Big Look Committee, but I believe that Measure 49 passed after the Big Look Committee, and it was passed 60-40. The cost impact of this is obscene at this time when seniors are going without in-home care. To waste $600,000 on this is a travesty when there are so many people with disabilities and elderly who need in-home care and other types of health care. That's it.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Brian Hines. My wife and I have worked with a group called the Keep Our Water Safe Committee in South Salem for about 5 years. So we're very familiar with what happens when there's an attempt to rezone farmland, when county commissioners are the ones making the decisions. I'm not trying to denigrate county commissioners or legislators or politicians, but they're not the ones to be making land use decisions. We've seen the decision in Marion County overturned by the courts, in Yamhill County by the courts. Our neighbors are not, by kind of courteously disagreeing with the co-chair, that we have two Oregons. In our area, we have one neighborhood. We have Republicans and Democrats. We have conservatives and progressives. We have leaf-driving people like me. We have pickup-driving hunters. And they all were concerned when there was an attempt to convert a farmland into a subdivision after they had bought their property, trusting that the rezoning process would be fair, equitable, in accordance with the land use system that was in place when they bought their property. Then suddenly they learned that we could have a subdivision next door. They could dry up our wells, that could dry up our community lake. And that struck people as unfair. And for 5 years, I went to committee, to county commission hearings, heard people, talked afterwards, said, what are they doing? The facts don't support this. And we would hear commissioners saying, I just feel like they should be allowed to do this. Politically, their values were such, they favored what they viewed as property rights. And we would all say, what about our property rights? We've lived here for 20 years. We've built our homes. So this is where I would caution you about introducing a new political process in which four people, because each of those counties have three member county commissions, four people could enter into a compact in which there would be no public hearings at the county level. There would be one public hearing at the state level where these neighbors, people like me and the hundreds of people in our neighborhood, would get to speak for a few minutes after they have spent, you know, perhaps their life savings into their homes, watching the value of their homes go away. Because who knows? Why is the purpose of this bill? There already is a process for rezoning farm and forest land that's inaccurately designated, as the previous speaker said, or one of the previous speakers. So we wonder, what's the purpose of this bill? Why are we spending $600,000 on it? And why don't we trust the process of public involvement that we have now in Oregon? Thank you.
My name is Sarah Doimling. Yes, I'm supposed to greet you. I'm committee and co-chairs. My name is Sarah Doimling. I live in rural Polk County on timberland that I manage and own. I feel like after the introduction to this bill, I have to establish some sort of credibility and apologize for living in the Willamette Valley. I grew up on a farm in Clackamas County. I have a brother who farms in Coos County, and I have a sister who farms in Jefferson County. So it's hard to speak to a group who feels like they're two Oregons. Some of us kind of straddle both. You have my written testimony, and in the interest of brevity, please read it, and I won't read it to you. I have a lot of sympathy for the fact that there are parcels of land in this state that perhaps could be used better. I think one law never answers every particular situation. There are always exceptions. I also feel that we've had attempts to change our land use laws in Oregon before that have been something other than they led us to believe initially, and we've had some trouble with that. I believe very strongly that our farm and forest land is the bedrock of Oregon's economy. It's the part of our economy that, if we treat it right, will always be there. It won't be tempted to leave to another state that offers a better tax deal. We have great potential to add more value-added products in both of those industries, the agriculture and the forest industry. I think we've been led down the path of excessive development for the purpose of short-term financial gains for a few folks. I think there are a lot of things we have to be very, very cautious about. And this is one of them. I mean, there are parts of this bill that sound fine and are fine, but it could be opening the door to lots of problems that future generations will say, I wish they hadn't done that. I wish they would have left more options for us. So I will read you the last paragraph or two. I urge you to be very cautious when considering any loosening of our land use laws. Development, whether residential, commercial, or industrial, is very permanent, and it inevitably comes with some loss of quality of air, water, and soil. And those, I don't mean to sound trite, but all the money in the bank isn't going to do us any good, or all the development in the world, if we have diminished the quality of those three things, our water, our soil, and our air. And this is looking towards greater population and fewer per capita natural resources. Farm and forest lands and the multitude of products and jobs they produce cannot move to another state. These lands are integral to Oregon. They are Oregon and will continue to reward us in perpetuity if we take care and protect them. And I would say, if you're convinced that this law is okay and will be dealt with thoughtfully, maybe.
Okay.
But we need
Your
to be
time
cautious.
Is up, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have Richard Van Pelt, Jason, I think it's Minor, and excuse me, I'll have Kathleen Carl come up too, please.
Co-chairs, members of the Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Van Pelt. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian, and I reside in that part of the state known as the Willamette Valley. I'm concerned about the state of Oregon, and I believe that House Bill 4095 takes Oregon, the word Oregon, out of Oregon's land use planning. Despite 40 years of support for the concept of statewide land use planning, this body seems set on legislating that we as Oregonians accept that some who claim to be Oregonians are exempt from principles that we have enacted as applying to us all. House Bill 4095 allows some counties at the favors some counties at the expense of everyone else. I readily acknowledge advocates' arguments that one size does not always fit all. But existing law already provides for tailoring land use issue guidelines to factor in unique sub-state conditions. I would support such a bill if it were crafted in a way that recognized the overarching land use principle that we Oregonians have supported for four decades.
House Bill 4095 sets selected counties above the people and allows those counties to make decisions contrary to statewide policy and adversely affecting those in the selected counties who have striven to prosper under the statewide land use system. This is a deeply flawed bill that undermines four decades of land use policy and that has set Oregon as a model nationwide and worldwide, and then asks us to pay for the cost of their seceding from Oregon and those areas where it suits the interests of the few at the expense of the interests of all. Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify on HB 4095. My name is Jason Miner. I'm the Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. 1000 Friends of Oregon is opposed to HB 4095. The bill does two things. It enables regional definitions for Southern Oregon of EFU land, and it introduces new criteria for consideration in that definition. As has been mentioned by previous testimony, regional definitions of EFU land are already possible. In fact, Eastern and Western Oregon have different definitions of farmland. LCDC, if it feels compelled to create a separate definition for Southern Oregon, has the authority to do so already. That power already exists. Secondly, there was previous testimony that some land is miszoned or has been mischaracterized as agriculture or forestry land. It was a consideration of the Big Look Task Force, so recently convened, to address that problem, and HB 2229 was adopted specifically to allow for remapping in counties where mapping of agriculture or forestry land was had incorrect application. That law has been on the books since 2009, and as of yet, no county has chosen to implement 2229 to do that remapping. That authority is out there, and 1000 Friends of Oregon strongly supports it and has emphasized in Southern Oregon that if the need exists and is recognized to remap lands that need to be remapped, 2229 is there to do it, and we support that. The second element of the bill is the redefinition of introduction of definitions into EFU that have nothing to do with farming or agriculture. Section 2 of the bill introduces criteria like the proximity of EFU land to non-farm, non-forest uses. I think that this stands our land use system on its head. One of the more effective or one of the more successful elements of land use planning in Oregon is the urban growth boundary, separation of urban uses and urban conflicts from rural uses and rural conflicts, keeping rural residential development from impeding the practice of agriculture. To introduce these kind of criteria changes the urban growth boundary from a boundary to something more like a target. Incentivizing and changing the criteria whereby farmland adjacent to urban growth boundaries, by virtue of its proximity to non-farm, non-forest uses, is suddenly more likely to be defined not as EFU. That's contrary to what the system is in place to prevent conflicts between farm and non-farm uses and the orderly deployment of services in urban areas. I think that that's just one example of criteria that probably shouldn't be introduced into the definition of EFU. Finally, we've been participants in the Bear Creek Regional Problem-Solving Process, long process that's been designed to introduce flexibility or allow for flexibility for Southern Oregon in the land use planning process. That's coming to its conclusion in this year. It's been a long process by which local governments have come together and found ways to apply.
No, thank you.
I would just say that look closely at the Bear Creek process. I think this bill undermines its success.
Who is next there?
I'm Kathleen Carl. I'm also a fifth-generation Oregonian. I'm a co-owner of a farm in Hubbard in the Willamette Valley. My sister is actually the farmer in the family. That's where she is now, clearing out flooded land from all the sticks and things. First, I'd like to say I don't think that these southern counties have difficulty because of land use laws. I think there are other factors, economic factors, that are making the difficulty there. I don't think the land use laws are causing that difficulty. Second, I believe in the consistency of using state laws and that courts make rulings on it. I think that's why we have a Supreme Court in the United States, that we have a consistency at the top that we can count on and believe in. And also mentioned of the House Bill 2229, in which there is possibility of remapping for lands that are not really farm and forest land. And I'd just like to say, when my grandparents moved from Coos County to the Willamette Valley, they cut down enormous trees that I think now, if they knew what those would be worth now, that they would have saved many more than they did. And I think that we do not really realize the value in 2012 of those, of this farmland and forest land 50 years from now, and we need to save it. Thank you.
Thank you. There are some that came in late, did not get on the list. And if I put all of you on the list, we don't even get to the next bill, so I'm going to have to be selective. I'm going to take one that was for, one that was against on the late people, and the remainder that are on this list. I want to have Sean Gillians, Dave Honeycutt, and Sean Cleave.
It's probably downstairs.
He was downstairs.
Sean, is he left? Is he not here?
I think he's probably downstairs,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
He was in the overflow room.
You guys can go ahead and start. You'll probably be coming up.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Certainly appreciate the testimony today. I think it's been an interesting opportunity to talk about our land use system. I quite honestly wish that the bill went half as far as people claim that it does. This bill will not destroy UGBs. This bill will not take away the state's land use planning system. If you look closely at the bill, you'll see that this allows a pilot project for three counties to petition back to LCDC for a regional definition of farm and forest. It doesn't take LCDC or the state out of the equation. It actually allows them to go back. I was doing a little research over the weekend about the unemployment rates in those three counties. Douglas is at 12.3%, Jackson 11%, Josephine County 11.7%. I don't think I need to tell you all that because you've all lived it, especially Representative Hicks, as you represent that region. We've heard a lot about the Big Look Task Force. I think a lot of us were skeptical of it, and yet at the same time they came out with some good recommendations. They spent many years looking at our land use system. They concluded their work in 2008 and submitted recommendations in 2009 to Representative Nolan's Land Use Committee. I actually have no life, so I went back and read their report this weekend. And there's a couple things I'll just read out of there, and I know you're pressed for time, Mr. Chair, but it said, back when zoning designations on resource lands were adopted in the 1970s, state and local governments had limited technical information compared to today. Planners were dealing with the economics and technology of then, not now. This is an opportunity to modernize our land use system. It's not an opportunity to blow out UGBs or bypass the state. I appreciate that you all supported this last legislative session, and I would hope that you would support it again. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of this bill. I want to make it clear what this bill does, because I think there's the rhetoric is a little bit overblown on this bill. What we're talking about is a bill that that gives three counties the opportunity to form an intergovernmental agreement, work together, and petition LCDC. So they'd be working with the state, and whatever the three counties do, they will have to get the permission of LCDC in order to make the changes to the goals to create, because LCDC is the agency that adopts the goals, to create the regionalized definition of farm and forest land for those three counties. So the county will certainly be an active participant in this, which is as well they should. They're the ones that are familiar with the farm and forest economy in their area. They're the ones that do the mapping. They're the ones that are on the ground when somebody comes in and submits an application. They know their county. But the end result will be a decision, if this bill were to be approved, the end result would be a decision by LCDC to amend their goals, which is exactly the same process that they have in place now. The other point about this bill, we're not trying, the bill isn't purported to
to take agricultural and forest land out of production. What the bill is designed to do is to identify those areas where, for one reason or the other, given the breadth of the definition of ag land in Goal 3 and forest land in Goal 4, we have land that doesn't fit. There's 97% of the privately owned rural land in this state is zoned for farm and forest land. Out of that 97%, there are some areas where the definition of farm and forest land just doesn't work very well. And so the purpose of this bill is to give the counties and the state, working together, the opportunity to identify those particular areas, come up with a petition and a presentation that the counties can make to the commission, with the ultimate decision resting with the commission. We think this is a smart bill, a good bill, a much-needed bill, and we would urge your support.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to thank the two gentlemen sitting to my left for demonstrating what I would read into the bill as a fairly good analysis of what the bill purports to do. I will also say that the Oregon Farm Bureau has been a longtime advocate of regionalization for LCDC and DLCD. However, we do have strong concerns regarding the specific mechanisms for regionalization under this bill. We don't believe that Goal 3 and Goal 4 agricultural forest land should be provided to the counties or to any region for specific definitions that may be different than the statewide goals. I can say, just speaking from experience over some legislation that passed 4 years ago in the metro area, that this bill could ultimately be what I would consider purchasing a used car sight unseen. This body can't be aware of specifically what those definitions are, nor can the three of us sitting at this dais be aware of what those definitions will ultimately be. I do think that, unfortunately, through our process, sometimes we push concepts through after the fact because we've expended time and resources at the state level or the county level, even though at the end we may not agree with the end results. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and be available for any questions if you have.
Garrett had a specific question.
I have a couple questions, if that's all right. Sean, on the definitions, it's not the case that the counties would be coming up with their own definitions, though, correct? It would be done in conjunction with LCDC.
That is correct. It would be definitions that the three counties would agree to in conjunction with LCDC.
Okay, and then, if I may, Mr. Chair, for Mr. Honeycutt, Mr. Jillian's, or all, any of you actually, can you address the point that Mr. Miner made that we allowed for some regional definition innovation in the Big Look Bill 2229? I'm unclear, I guess, on how this bill goes beyond that and why it's necessary given what we did in 2009.
Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Garrett, I think I can answer that question. House Bill 2229, we call it the Big Look Task Force Bill. It really wasn't the Big Look Task Force Bill. The Big Look Task Force came out with the original version of 2229, which I think the committee and just about everybody who follows land use thought wasn't really a very good bill. So House Bill 2229 in its enrolled version is completely different from the bill that the Big Look Task Force proposed. What that bill did is it gave counties, well, and LCDC, the ability to go in and take another look at the farm and forest land zoning in the rural areas, but only consistently with the definition of agricultural land in Goal 3 and forest land in Goal 4. And so it was designed to fix those areas that somehow were zoned for farm or forest use but fell outside the definition of ag land in Goal 3 or forest land in Goal 4. There's already a process for that. I've done that before, but you were still stuck with the definitions of ag and forest land in Goals 3 and 4. What this bill does is it gives the three counties the ability to go to petition LCDC and get LCDC to adopt a regional definition of Goal 3 and 4 that may be different from the existing definition of Goal 3 and Goal 4. So this bill would allow the three counties to petition the commission and get a regionalized definition, make an amendment to the definition of Goal 3 and Goal 4, not just go out and find land that may be zoned farm or forest land, but fall outside the existing definition of Goal 3 and 4. That's what 2229 did. And I do want to clear up, there are counties that have been interested in going forward with 2229. Matter of fact, I wrote an article for our Looking Forward newsletter a couple years ago asking LCDC to hurry up and draft the rulemaking for 2229, but we don't have rulemaking done for 2229. So it's tough for a county to go forward under 2229 when the commission hasn't adopted the rulemaking for it yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Further? Okay, thank you. I am going to call up two more, and we're going to shorten it up. We've got a whole other bill to do. We've only got a half an hour. I want to have Peggy Lynch and Connie Young, please. And that will be the last two on this bill. We'll never get through.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. And first of all, I want to say that we have local leagues in the Rogue Valley and the Umpqua Valley. And my personal bona fides are I'm a native Oregonian and I have relatives in probably every county in this state. You have my written testimony, or you should have my written testimony that was sent in Friday to be sure that that it came before you. I will try not to repeat what you have heard before. I do want to make a couple of comments, though. The House Bill 2229 not only does what you heard from Mr. Honeycutt, but it also sets different criteria for what is farm and forest lands. And so that's a concern to us. We keep hearing that there had been there were mistakes and that we need to do remapping. The League accepts and agrees that we need to look at remapping within the definitions, the scientific definitions of what is farm and forest land. Of real concern is the issue about losing our good industrial lands, and our ag and forest, private forest lands are our industrial lands, and they are critical to us. Many of you have worked on industrial lands issues related to Intel and other kinds of things, but these are other industrial lands that are important to rural Oregonians. I won't get into the budget issue. I'm assuming that's a discussion that will be held. I do want to say that that there are a number of cities in periodic review, and the energy and the monies that are needed to make sure that those cities help us with our job situation should be spent on that. The LCD is working to address issues such as a safe harbor on population forecasting, which is a part of the issue surrounding how we expand urban growth boundaries. That's an issue that's of critical importance to all over Oregon, including southern Willamette Valley. And additionally, you have heard minimally about Jackson County is completing a regional problem-solving project. For those of you in the Portland metro area, you know about the Metro Urban and Rural Reserves Project. The Bear Creek RPS was a much longer process and is close to completion, but it is not complete. The county itself has adopted it, but the cities have not, and you still have a ways to go. There will be thousands of acres added to the urban growth boundaries in that area once that project is finished. And then we need to make sure there is the opportunity to implement that process. Okay. I would ask that you let this bill die in committee. Thank you.
My name is Connie Young. I'm here for myself. I'm a member of Farm Bureau, but I'm not speaking for Farm Bureau. I was born and raised in Josephine County. I lived on a farm out in the Applegate Valley for 72 years. And as my husband and I farmed it for 50. We just recently moved up here. It got where we couldn't keep our farm anymore. I was the third generation, and my children are and grandchildren are the fourth and fifth generation that were there on that farm. And as when it come to the time when we had to hire help, we couldn't afford it because my husband was no longer working for Boise Cascade Corporation. And that was what kept us going. Every single year, we fought for water. We fought for being able to use fertilizers. We fought for everything that we used because the environmental movement moved in there. They shut down the timber industry. My family was involved in the timber industry, mining and farming. And they need some kind of different laws than what you put up with up here, what you designate as laws for farming up here. They need something else down there because even the intense farming, my father sold tomatoes to Bagley Canning Company, which was in Ashland when I was a teenager. He sold corn on the corner there. We did everything that we could think of. We had dairy cattle. Then we went to beef cattle. We raised hay. We bought our own machinery, and most of it was old, and every winter we spent that time trying to patch up what was wrong on each one of them. Believe me, repairs are pretty darned expensive. But I would just try to talk you into looking at this bill and voting yes on it and maybe making that into a different region. It's a pilot project, so if it doesn't work, just fix it if it doesn't work. But I just feel that the farmers down there do need some help. They need some somebody up here to look at them because it seems to me that none of you pay attention to anything south of Eugene, and we have felt that way my whole entire life. So I just urge you to please think about going with this and give us a chance down there to maybe change things a little bit and maybe be able to keep our farms and to be able to stay on the land and not have to fight for water. Just give us a chance. We appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to get on the next bill. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4095. Representative Barker is going to have the gavel on the next bill. Public hearing on House Bill 4045. Mr. Taylor, two members of the committee, House Bill 4045 comes to you from Representative Thatcher allows a person applying for concealed handgun permit to request confidentially the person's identity. I'm going to just briefly, technically, in closing House Bill 4045 hearing, reopening the hearing on House Bill 4095, and that bill will be carried over until Wednesday. Okay, reopen the hearing on House Bill 4045.
Chairman of the committee, 45 allows a person applying for concealed handgun permit to request confidentiality of the person's identity, allows a public body to disclose the information to another public body for criminal justice purposes or if the court in a civil criminal case orders the information disclosed to another public body, applies to applications submitted prior to the effective date of this act if the person has communicated that he or she wants confidentiality effective upon passage. Chair members of the committee, there are about 11 amendments to this bill. I have to admit, I just received them this morning, and I have not read them. I am aware of the Dash 10, which would take the court records out of this provision. Other than that, I'm not familiar with any of the amendments.
Mr. Taylor. Daryl Fuller, Bob Wolf, and Brian Wallace. Oh, I'm sorry. First, Representative Thatcher, please.
For the record, my name is Kim Thatcher, State Representative for House District 25, Kaiser, Newburgh, and St. Paul. Excuse me. Well, this bill is familiar to most of you. It's very similar to the bill passed last session, passed the House 42-18. It was also adopted in 2009 in the House. The bill is designed to protect the very personal information about people who are trying to exercise their Second Amendment rights. But in order to do so, they would have to get a piece of paper from the government in order to do that. So this bill says if you apply for this concealed handgun license and you check on a box stating you do not want your information disclosed or released to the public, then the sheriff would not be able to disclose anything about your CHL application. And we're talking about information that's not only includes your name, home address, home phone number, potentially your email address, whether or not you've been, it has asked a question about whether you've been convicted of drug issues or have gone through drug diversion or were dishonorably discharged from the military, or sometimes some applications will ask for your employer's address and your occupation. Well, I had a stack of what those applications are. They ask various things. They're not exactly uniform. The different counties will do things a little bit differently. The public bodies that possess this information would be allowed to divulge these records under three conditions under this bill. It's under a court order for criminal justice purposes or if the CHL holder specifically allows the information to be released. And when we're talking about public records in general, we're talking about allowing the public to monitor activities of government agencies. And these records are not about government activities. It's about private data collected on people in trying to exercise their rights. Now, for the opponents who say these records are about government activities, that we have to keep an eye on the sheriffs, make sure they're not doing anything wrong, I would say that we do have mechanisms in place. We have agencies like the state police, we have the attorney general, we have federal agencies, and probably many others who would come in and take a look if there's any whiff of impropriety amongst what the sheriffs are doing. We already protect gun records from disclosure. For example, gun background checks on gun purchases are not released. And this bill would add consistency to that law because, first of all, you don't have to have a permit to own a gun, and just because you have a CHL does not mean that you do own a gun. People get them, CHLs, for many reasons. Sometimes they're victims of domestic violence or stalking. Maybe they're carrying big, thousands of dollars or a bunch of money to the night deposit after their shift, and they just want a little protection. Now, the state police is worried that they would need more time to update their computer system to screen out agencies that are currently accessing LEDS, the law enforcement data system, and limit the data release for only criminal justice purposes. So I have an amendment that would move the start date to January 1st and make this bill effective January 1st next year. We also didn't want to create a fiscal for the sheriffs or OSP or in state police, so I have an amendment to get rid of that part about checking the box and just bring back the same bill from last year, just simplifying it, just make the CHL records off limits to public disclosure, except in those circumstances regarding criminal justice purposes, courts, and if it's specifically allowed by the CHL holder. Finally, the courts and the Oregon Judicial Department came forward basically last week or Friday. It's concerned about all the court records that they may have on file, which may or may not indicate somebody has a CHL. So they indicated they wouldn't have the resources to redact all those current records. So I have an amendment that would also, in that same amendment, actually, it's -14, would exclude court records from this ban on disclosure, and that should address their concerns. Like I said, it's in the -14 amendments, and I have handed to me this morning a stack of additional amendments that you were kind of alluding to earlier. I have not had a chance to absorb what they all mean, but this, what I'm coming forward with is a very simple bill. And it has to do with disclosure of records, and I don't know what those other bills do, but I could be mucking that all up, and I hope that you just kind of take into consideration the simpleness of what's being put forward. Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thatcher, so are the -14 amendments currently the ones that you are supportive of?
Yes, okay. -14s are the ones that I came forward with, and they delay the start time for OSP to address any of their concerns. It exempts court records from this compliance, and it also does one more thing.
It's the fiscal.
Oh, it changes it back to the other bill. Yeah. So it addresses any fiscal, potential fiscal or resource issues, and just brings it back to what we were, what I was proposing last session, that, and that passed in the House. So.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Thatcher, can you explain to me, this is a pretty technical question, about the portion of ORS where you're proposing to put this this language separate from the public records section of the statute? And can you explain to me why you made that why you made the choice to keep it separate from all the other statute that refers to public records?
Well, it is, like it says at the top of the bill, it says it amends 166-291. And my impression of the public records law is that it presents, it doesn't ever keep anything off limits. It just presents a Byzantine maze where if you go through it right, you can get to those records. So that is why. Just simplifying it, just making it off limits.
Quick follow-up. Thank you for the explanation, but I'm a bit confused. If we're creating an entire new section, well, it's in a different section, then what we have is two places where people have to look in ORS, which is tough enough to get through, just to understand what the rules would be about public records.
Well, Representative Nolan, I know that the legislature passes numerous laws that the agencies have to look at, and I'm sure that they can handle looking at two sections.
And just one final comment. I'm not concerned about the agencies. I suspect they can figure it out. I'm concerned about the general public having a tough enough time navigating their way through the statute.
I'm not sure why that would be a problem about the general public wanting these records.
I need to know what the rules
about,
are.
Well, I guess they could call up their sheriff, and the sheriff would, I mean, that's probably who they would be contacting, and the sheriff can school them, I guess, on what the law is.
Thanks.
Representative Thatcher, prior to the board decision about the records might be, you know, one sheriff was ordered that he had to give, I think everybody was underneath the impression that they were confidential to start with. Now we're simply fixing that. That's what you're attempting
that is,
to do.
That is correct. I guess, you know, this is something that I remember hearing a lot when I was on the Judiciary Committee a few years ago. This would be codifying current practice. So just continue. It would just continue that practice.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Briefly, you know, in relating to Representative Nolan's questions, I think I represent about everyday Joe you can find, and they ain't going to go look up the ORS and crack open the statute. They just want their information kept confidential. That's what we're doing. That's the only answer they need. That's what they want to hear. They want to make sure that's it. It's pretty simple, really. Nobody's going to go look into the ORS. Regular guys and gals ain't going to do that. They ain't going to want to do that. They're going to ask the sheriff, is this confidential? Yes. That's what the law says, and they move on.
Right.
That's how it works in the real world, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daryl Fuller, Bob Wolf, and Brian Wallace.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I want to apologize on behalf of Sheriff Wolf from Polk County, who was here at the beginning of the hearing but had to leave for a meeting at 10 o'clock with his commissioners. And I simply want to express that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association has worked closely with Representative Thatcher on the original language of the bill. We have had a chance to look at the Dash 14s and would support those as well. There are a number of other amendments that we have not had a chance to review, so we're not able to comment on those. But we encourage you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Rachel Lucas could come up too, please. Go ahead, please.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the Chief Civil Deputy at the Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here to represent Oregon sheriffs and my sheriff, Jason Myers, and myself, of course. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4045, and thank you for the opportunity. I wanted to start out with the definition of concealed. That means to hide, withdraw, or remove from observation, cover, or keep from sight. Second part of that definition is to keep secret, to prevent or avoid disclosing or divulging. I've seen several versions of this bill in the last few sessions. I believe that this particular bill is well-crafted in that it addresses everyone's concerns, I hope, and it also gives the concealed handgun license holder the decision as to whether or not their license should be public knowledge by indicating that in writing. Representative Thatcher touched on a few scenarios, but I'd like you to imagine a few for just 1 second. Imagine a small business owner who carries large sums of money to the bank, perhaps sometimes late at night. Imagine a woman who's terrified that her father is going to hunt her down and cause her harm or even death. Imagine a person who lives alone and has been subjected to a stalker. And also imagine a person who, by no choice of their own, works or lives in a high crime area and has fell victim to robbery, theft, or assault at some point in their life. So imagine that. Now I want you to stop imagining and understand that that's reality. And there are holders out there that do not want their information revealed because of those very reasons. I had an opportunity to speak at length with a person not too long ago about their family situation who was referred to me. I'm not going to disclose that person's sex or which county this person has a concealed handgun license, as this person is in hiding. This person was deeply concerned about their safety and the confidentiality of their application. We discussed at length the steps this person could take to disappear from the abuse that this person escaped. I've submitted written testimony. There's a couple of statistics in there that you would probably find interesting. One being that out of the 9,300 holders of a concealed handgun license in Marion County, only roughly 75 have indicated that they don't care if their concealed handgun license is a public record. That's less than 1%. More precisely, that's 0.8%. Overwhelmingly, the rest of the holders in our county have indicated that they don't want their Social Security number, driver's license number, date of birth, height, weight, sex. The list goes on, all of that information, where they're employed, to be revealed. To sum up, last night I had a deja vu. And I remember last session when Representative Schaffler commented on House Bill 2692 and how he thought that it didn't make sense that we had to pass a law to keep the sheriff from being instructed to sell an identification document. Do you remember that? Such as a driver's license.
Piece of legislation.
Right. And that was to be sold by the sheriff at a sheriff's sale pursuant to a court-ordered writ. And I agreed with the representative from Happy Valley, and the bill passed, but it became to be known as the selling of passports bill. So today I find myself thinking back to April, but this time with a little bit more seriousness and with a little bit more passion. And I ask again, here I am again, that you prevent sheriffs in selling someone's identity, because if a high court later decides that sheriffs are to release information of a concealed handgun license holder, despite that person's desire for confidentiality, that's exactly what we're going to have to do. The bill's sensible, it's reasonable, it's sensitive to everyone's concerns, and I thank you for your time today, and would be happy to answer any questions after everyone's testimony. Thanks.
We're a little short of time. Couple more people.
Yeah. Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger, thank you for letting me appear today. You no longer have to imagine the scenario of a vulnerable person who, because I am that person. And I didn't want to come here today. This is my third time testifying in the last three sessions, the fourth or fifth time. And but I came because as a sexual...
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Rachel Lucas. I didn't want to come today, and I actually expressed that to someone in this room, but after thinking about it, I cannot not come, because it does need to be on the record that for people who cannot come forward, who do not have a voice, like the woman or man or child that this man next to me was referring to. There are so many of us out there that can't come forward that, once again, just like I did when I testified against my rapist, I took that risk so that other people would not be hurt. And I ask today that our records do be kept private. When I got my CHL, I was shocked to find out just a couple of months later that that information was possibly made public. It's just a violation of the intent of the law. As he said, it should be concealed. And I just want to touch on one other thing. I know you all have heard my testimony before, most of you have. I know that there are two levels of violation that this does to people like me. And one is that it provides a lack of safety because my perpetrator from his imprisonment can find my records more easily than I can find his. He can track me more easily than I can track him. Then there's the second level, and that, of course, poses a danger if he should be released. There's a second danger, and that's the one that's the hardest one to talk about and the hardest one to, I think, for people to grasp, but it's not for me. And that is the one that it's simply re-violating to have someone who has sexually violated you have access to your personal information. They had access to your person in a way that you did not allow. And I expected the law and the government to protect me in that kind of way. And I sit here and I see faces of people who advocate for the rights and protection of vulnerable women. And I would ask you that you look and see. There were laws that when this first happened to me, there were laws, well-meaning laws, that harmed me and that re-violated me, that gave my perpetrator access to personal information, not this time, not for a CHL. And I worked hard to fix those laws so that other people were not re-violated. I sit here before you today for that same reason. I know that many laws are well-meaning, but we do not want to have what we call a security show, where laws that are supposed to protect or purport to protect vulnerable people actually allow vulnerable people to be violated. And I'll take any questions. Thank you. I did pass out something here that should answer some of them that were asked last time here in this committee.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying again. Appreciate seeing you. This is for one of the sheriff's representatives. So is it required by law that all the information we're hearing, social security number, et cetera, all of that be given out as the law is now, or is it just the name?
Co-chairs and Representative Tomei, there's a Court of Appeals case that has affirmed a Jackson County court ruling in that all records are public records unless there's an exception. And what the courts ruled with concealed handgun licenses is that a sheriff can't make the assumption that someone has a CHL, concealed handgun license, for the purposes of protecting themselves or their property. Although that's a pretty safe assumption. I don't know what they would...
I know we're short on time and I don't need a long answer.
Yeah.
What I want to know is it required by law now that the sheriff's office give out all the information that Rachel was referring to, including social security number?
Yes, except for the social security number and a driver's license number. I believe that all sheriffs would redact that information just because of the Real ID Act.
Thank you.
But all other information, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Penny. And as we're short on time, I'll call up next Gail Meyer and Penny Okamoto. Go ahead, Gail.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill. I'm only speaking to make sure that it's understood that we also at times have a legitimate need to have access to this information. There are several defenses that are available to a defendant or correspondingly, the state has to prove whether or not the defendant had a reasonable apprehension or concern for imminent physical injury, and whether or not that belief or concern or that risk was reasonable. And to that end, then, frequently showing that someone else in an encounter was a CHL holder would be evidence to show that the defendant acted in self-defense or in defense of property or out of a reasonable apprehension of harm. So I don't think there's any dispute as to this. I've spoken with Chair Barker and I've spoken with Representative Thatcher. I would just simply point out that there's two ways in which the subsection A of the bill wouldn't cover us, because when the defense issues a subpoena for this information, we are not another public body. The subpoena is issued in the name of the defendant, and so subsection A really wouldn't apply to us. There are times prior to trial when we would go to a court then, and we would get a court order authorizing us to issue a subpoena, and then that would be protected in subsection B. There's only those instances where, based on time permitting, perhaps the defense just found out that somebody was at the scene, they couldn't get the court order, and then what they would do is issue a trial subpoena. And they would ask the sheriff then to come to the courtroom with the evidence at trial. And then it would be up to the court to make a determination whether or not the disclosure could be made to the defense. So I just want to make sure that it's understood that we would still be able to authorize our subpoena rights for trial.
Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger, committee members, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Penny Okamoto. I'm the Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. Representative Tomei, out of all due respect, I think I have an answer to your question that you had just posed. The law requires that only the name, the county of residence, and the age actually be disclosed.
That's not true.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
You misunderstood, but that's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. We do oppose 4045. We do believe that people who are victims of violence already have the opportunity to have this information withheld. That's actually simply by checking a box on the applications. Also, there is, you can actually go to the Oregon's Address Confidentiality Program, set for an ORS 192-820 to 868, which will already protect the information of people who have been victims of violence. I'd like to remind everyone, too, that concealed carry is a privilege granted by the state. Concealed carry is not a right. And to balance that right of people who do not conceal carry, we need to know who has a concealed carry gun under his or her jacket or in a bag. We'd also like to state that this could impede a victim's right to know if an attacker has a weapon, which has not yet been brought up. And also we'd like to state that we do not know of any harm that has come from people having access to this information. Have any criminals contacted the sheriffs looking for people who have concealed handguns to go steal their guns? I don't think that's happened. So I urge you to oppose 4045, and I thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Close the hearing on House Bill 4045. Adjourned. I'm sorry, carry it forward, reopen, just to be sure. Technically, we're going to move 4045 forward. We have 11 amendments showed up this morning that are really have nothing to do with the records. They're just trying to get and stuff the bill, but we'll take a look at those. I haven't had a chance to look at them. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.